I want you to turn, please, to James chapter number 4, and it's my intent to finish up this chapter this evening, and then, Lord willing, move into chapter number 5 on next week. I'm going to get my things all arranged here so that nothing falls off the pulpit. The lip on this thing is only an inch high, and I had a pretty high stack there. I want you to take note of what we've looked at so far in the epistle of James. So far, we've seen the salutation or the greeting. We've seen trials and temptations, which emphasizes trials. We've seen poverty and wealth. We've seen trials and temptations again, this time, which is emphasizing the temptations. We've seen the Word of God. We've seen partiality, faith and works. We've seen the use and misuse of the tongue. We've seen true and false wisdom, we've seen wicked desires, and we've seen God's provision for deliverance. As we go on into verses 11 and 12, we will see the slandering of one another. Interesting, isn't it? Believers seem to have a problem with that little thing in their mouths, okay? I'm guessing that this is in other churches, all right? Not here, of course. Believers should not be slandering one another, because by slandering a fellow believer, they are judging him and slandering the law. It says, "Speak not evil one of another, brethren. He that speaketh evil of his brother and judgeth his brother, speaketh evil of the law and judgeth the law. But if thou judge the law, thou art not a doer of the law, but a judge." Verse 11 is indicating that believers should no longer be characterized by slandering each other or by judging one another. "Speak not evil of" is an imperative or command with a negative, whose tense indicates that something is already being practiced and needs to be stopped. It's understood in the sense of stop speaking evil of, stop speaking against, stop defaming, or stop slandering. They're not talking about unsaved people doing this. These are people that are saved people. And I'm afraid it still happens in our local churches. I say that very kindly because I know good and well it still happens in our churches. One of another is simply one another or each other. James is addressing his readers as brethren or as brothers, by which he indicates his belief that they are fellow believers and members of the family of God. "He that speaketh evil of" is the one who is speaking evil of, the one who is speaking against, the one who is defaming, or the one who is slandering. And its tense indicates that this is going on habitually or repeatedly. In case you weren't aware of it, believers are too often very critical of each other, as if we don't have faults of our own. Of course, as I've said already, you realize that this is referring to believers in other churches. It's certainly not true in our church. Yeah, right. Okay, you know how that goes. "And he that judgeth his brother," the one who is judging or the one who's passing judgment on his brother, which means his fellow believer, the tense of judgeth indicates that this is going on habitually or repeatedly. Like I say, This is something which takes place only in other churches. By speaking evil of or defaming his brother, he's actually speaking evil of or defaming the law. The tense of speaketh evil indicates that this action is happening habitually or repeatedly. He's not practicing what the law says he's to be practicing. By speaking evil of or defaming his brother, he's judging or passing judgment upon other people and thereby seeking to influence their lives and actions as if he knows what's best for them. Now, sometimes he does know what's best for them, but he ought to be talking to them instead of to others, all right? Seeking to influence their lives and actions in the sense that he passes an unfavorable judgment upon, criticizes, finds fault with, or condemns. Once again, its tense is indicating that this actioning is happening habitually or repeatedly. If thou judge the law is, for sake of discussion, assumed to be true. And if it's actually true, the conclusion, thou art not a doer of the law, but a judge, will also be true. Now, of course, if the condition is false, the conclusion will likewise be false. But inasmuch as no one really knows whether the condition will actually be true for a particular individual, if should be understood in the sense of assuming that. You know, as I read this and go through it tonight, I remember something my father used to say frequently, and I don't know why it had to be frequently. Well, yes, I really do. It was, if you don't have something nice to say, don't say anything, okay? Is it my place to be talking to you about somebody else? Not really. Is it your place to be talking to others about people? Be careful. We all fall into the same sort of problem. Thou judge. Thou, of course, starts with T. It's you, singular. And it refers to anyone in general. It's the same word translated judgeth in this verse and has the same meaning. Its tense indicates that this action is ongoing or habitual or repeated in the sense of you are judging. You are a doer, thou judge, a doer of the law, someone who is. Did I leave something out there? Seems like, doesn't. Oh, there it is. Thou art not a doer of the law, but a judge. Okay, that's where it was. I knew it was there somewhere. Thou, a doer of the law is someone who does what is prescribed by law, but here it's negated. A doer is the opposite of someone who's only a hearer. They both hear, but only one does what the law says. But this person is not doing what the law says. So if you're judging the law, you're not doing what the law says, but indicates a strong contrast between being a doer of law and a hearer. A judge is one who reaches a decision or passes judgment. By being critical of the law, he sets himself up as being above the law, a position only God can occupy. He has ceased obeying the law and becomes a judge of the law, and his attitude shows contempt for the law. He's become an interpreter of the law for other people and has judged them in the process in spite of the fact that he most likely does not know all the facts involved. Keep that last part of that statement in mind. Oftentimes people are critical of others, but they really don't know what that other person is going through. You ever been criticized? No, not really. Oh yeah, right. Yes, you have been. And did the person who was doing the yakking against you really know what was going on? Sometimes maybe, but many times, absolutely not. As we move into verse 12, we see that believers should not be intruding into matters which God alone must deal with. What are we trying to do? Take God's place? I'm afraid we sometimes do, don't we? Or at least people in other churches do. Yeah, right. There is one lawgiver, one who is able to save and to destroy. Who art thou that judgest another? There's one lawgiver where one has been placed in a position of emphasis in the Greek text reads this way, one is the lawgiver. The implication of this is that this one lawgiver is God rather than any of James' readers, which of course we are doing now. We are reading James, so it is including us. There's one lawgiver who is able to save and to destroy. There's only one who can save and destroy. To save suggests to deliver from sin and its consequences. To destroy means to ruin and speaks of eternal ruin or destruction in the lake of fire. No one other than God is able to do either of these two things. So James asks, who art thou that judgest another? The implication of this question is that the one who is judging someone else has no business doing it. He's intruding into God's realm, into things which are God's business to do. He needs to mind his own business and stop trying to play God in someone else's life. Has this ever happened to me as a man, as a husband, as a father, as a teacher, as a pastor? You'd be shocked at some things I hear about myself as a pastor that just aren't quite the way I understood it. Of course it has. It happens all the time. Has it ever happened to you in any of the roles that you occupy? You know, each one of us has various roles in life. Of course it has. It happens all the time. How do you like it when you are the one being judged by some know-it-all? And I'm certain that your answer is just like mine, not very well. Being criticized goes against my old sin nature. It makes me want to get even with those people. That's not a good attitude, you know, but it's still in there. I wish it weren't. I wish I didn't have a sin nature. I used to tell my wife I wish she didn't have one too. she was a good lady, and I'm blessed to have had her, but we did have sin natures, and that's a problem in marriage. You take two people that think they're perfectly in love, and then they get married, and they find out before too long that the other spouse has an old sin nature. And then the song that we should sing at the close of a wedding, the fight is on. Or is it sound the battle cry? Take your pick. They both work well. How should we handle criticism, especially unjust criticism? in our new, sinless, Christ-like natures? Should we get mad and have a temper tantrum and never speak to this person again? Should we leave the church and never come back as long as that person is in it? I know this, I just stuck this next one in, but it doesn't apply to anybody here. But I'll ask it anyway, in case somebody over the internet is guilty. Is it possible that you might sometimes actually be the offender? No, couldn't happen. Rather than getting mad and defending ourselves against criticism, which is what is a normal response, a better way is to honestly evaluate the criticism and consider what part of it, if any, perhaps only 10% of it, is really true, and make a change for the better of whatever part of the criticism is really true. We're not yet perfect, and we know it, whether we want to admit it or not. So rather than retaliating, let's work at perfecting ourselves. I think one of the best things you can do if you are criticized, and I wish I could say I always followed my own advice, is say nothing as soon as you hear it. Okay? Go off and think about it. Maybe the person's got a point that's correct. Now, I know that's true only of me, not of you, right? We should remember that Romans 8:28, my wife wanted to put that verse on my tombstone. She didn't get to. We should remember that Romans 8:28 is true for us whenever we hear criticism of ourselves, whether we hear it directly or indirectly. We should ask ourselves, why did God allow this criticism of me to come to my attention? And instead of being furious with the critic, we should end up thanking the Lord for calling this to my attention so that it might get straightened out and that I might do better for him, even if the criticism is only partially correct. And I need to go on loving that person. Do you suppose my wife ever criticized me? Oh, no. You know she did. Do you suppose she ever made suggestions for me to improve my preaching? Every time I preached. If you just do such and such a thing instead of what you do. If we happen to be the offender, and I know this is, I'm talking here to people that are out there off on the internet, not in here. We should go to the person whom we've offended and seek to straighten the problem out with him and stop being the offender in the future. Easier said than done, isn't it? Unfortunately, it is possible, if not likely, that we have all been the offender at some point in time. Let's stop being the offender. If something needs to be pointed out to somebody, do it in a very kind fashion, especially if you're talking to me. Be as kind and sweet as you possibly can be. My feelings are so sensitive. You don't want me crying, do you? No, not likely, okay? Not likely going to happen, and not likely do you want that either. It's likely that we've all been involved. So he says, who art thou? where thou is you singular, it's also emphatic. You are who? And it amounts to, who do you think you are that judgest another? Is who are judging the other. Judgest is understood in the sense of passes an unfavorable judgment on, criticizes, finds fault with, or condemns. Sometimes what is said is not really as insulting as the way it gets repeated to us. We need to be careful. Let's be careful about being critical of other believers as if we are better than they are, as if we believe that we know better how to be doing everything they are doing than they do. That was one message. I'm going to give you a second one now. This was intentional. I knew that would be a little too short, okay? If you want a longer one, I've got a longer one coming Sunday night. I've already divided it in half, though, so that it won't be an hour and a half in length. As we move into verses 13 through 17, we see that the making of plans is being done without seeking God's will. Have we ever gone about and planned something and then done it, and it didn't turn out so well? No, that's other people. Maybe if we had asked God's approval or suggestions for improval, it would have been good. As we look at James 4, 13 through 17, we see that making plans without consulting God's direction is presumptuous, because no one knows what will happen on the next day. At best, one's life is brief and could end up at any time. It could end at any time. Some are priding themselves in their boastings, but boastings like these are evil. It is sin for someone to know to do good, but not to do it. In verse 13, we see that making plans without consulting God's direction is presumptuous. Go to now, ye that say, today or tomorrow we will go into such a city and continue there a year and buy and sell and get gain. In verse 13, the plan is to go to a particular city for a year and to buy and sell and make money. Go to now. Come on now. Go on now. And James is singling out some of his readers, addressing them as ye that say, you, plural, who are saying. Today or tomorrow indicates an indefinite time, but it's in the very near future. We'll go into such a city, where such as this one here, or this or that city, or such and such a city, and indicates a specific place to which these people fully intend to go. But these plans are too definite without consulting God. Now, of course, you and I need to be careful of doing the same thing as these people whom James is addressing are doing. And buy and sell. We'll carry on business, and we will buy and sell, and we will trade. What if you break your leg on the way to this city? What if you get there and nobody wants your product? Consult God. It's a whole lot better. They are predicting something which will definitely happen in their plan in the future, but God is left out of the plan. And get gain. We're going to get gain. We're going to make a profit. But there is no prayer asking for the Lord's direction. Now, I don't want my next statement to get involved with Jesse's Sunday school lesson, but it may. And if it does steal your thunder, Jesse, there's not enough people listening to me tonight to make any difference. So you just go right ahead and teach whatever you're going to teach. It reminds me of what the Gibeonites did in Joshua 9 when, in order not to be destroyed by the Israelites, they pretended to have come from a great distance and they asked to make a treaty with the Israelites. Now, the Gibeonites were one of the cities that was near. They were from one of the cities that was near where the Israelites were, and the Israelites were to totally destroy them. It says in Joshua 9, 14 and 15, and the men took of their victuals. Do you know what victuals are? Provisions, okay? I'll just help you out with that. And asked not counsel at the mouth of the Lord. They didn't pray about it. And Joshua made peace with them. It was a mistake. And made a league. A league, I thought that was a baseball. It was, but that's not the same kind of league we have here. A league is a treaty with them to let them live. And the princes of the congregation swear unto them. It doesn't mean they swore at them, but they took an oath. We should also ask the Lord for his guidance in everything we do. But all too often, I'm afraid that we fail to seek the Lord's direction. In the first half of verse 14, we see that no one knows what will happen on the next day. Whereas ye know not what shall be on the morrow. You suppose on September 11, was it 2001? A lot of people went to work in New York City expecting to come home that night. A bunch of them didn't make it, as you know. What's going to happen to you tonight? Well, we'd like to think nothing unusual, okay? But we all know that that may not be the case. Lots of people have had heart attacks and died. Lots of people have had strokes and ended up in the hospital. Lots of people have had car wrecks. They didn't plan on it, but it happened. I'm sure we've all experienced something by the end of a particular day that we had not anticipated. These are things that are normal in life. Verse 14 indicates that the people making the elaborate plan in verse 13 have no idea of what is going to happen on the next day. Each person's life is like a vapor. A little fog, you know, that is seen for a little while and then vanishes or disappears. They may live for many years, or they may not live past midnight tonight. Many people leave home each day, but before the day ends, some of them will unexpectedly be in the hospital, and others will unexpectedly be in eternity. For some people, everything goes as planned or expected. That's what it normally is in a day. But for others, something completely unexpected happens. And it's not always bad. It might actually be good sometimes. But it's often something over which we have no control. Whereas ye know not. Such ones as you do not know or are not acquainted with the thing of the next day. Such ones as you emphasizes a characteristic quality and is used in the sense of such ones as you to be sure, or such ones as you who by your very nature, ye, you plural, referring to a select group of James readers who are making an elaborate plan without consulting God. ye know not. You do not know. You are not acquainted with. And its tense indicates that this is descriptive of the truth regarding them. What shall be on the morrow? Where shall be is in italics, to show that it has been supplied by the translators, is the thing of the next day. No one knows for certain what lies ahead of him in life. I remember, it's a long time ago now, I was pastoring in Illinois, and it was in a meeting with teens. And the speaker said, you don't know what's going to happen within the next month. And one young man boasted that he did know. It's not a shock to you to learn that he was killed in a car wreck about a week later, and his brother was paralyzed for the rest of his life. Oh, they passed in what was a legal passing zone, but there was a dip in the road that was hiding a car coming from the opposite direction. But he knew what was going to happen, right? No, not a clue. Hope he was saved. In the second half of verse 14, we see the uncertainty of our lives. At best, one's life is brief and could pass away at any time. Yes, a couple of us are more mature than a couple of the others who are here. But we've never known what tomorrow is going to bring for certain. Same thing with you. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. For is introducing a question which provides an explanation of ye know not what shall be on the morrow. The question is, what is your life? What? Of what sort? Of what kind? Is? Describes these persons' lives as they make their plans. And it's been supplied by the translators because it's implied in the context. What is your life? Yours, plural, possessive. Referring to James' readers who are making an elaborate and definite plan without consulting God. Life refers to their physical life in the flesh. It, your life, is even a vapor. It's even, where even is the word ordinarily translated for, but it's understood in this verse in an emphatic sense as indeed, certainly, or in fact. Vapor is an old English spelling. V-A-P-O-R is the modern English spelling. Or mist. It's been placed in a position of emphasis in the Greek text, which reads literally, vapor or mist it is, that appeareth, the one which appears, the one which is visible, the one which becomes visible for a little time, for a short time. And then, thereupon, suggesting the next thing that happens after this mist appears for a little while, vanisheth away. It perishes. It disappears. Isn't it nice when the fog leaves? If you're driving, it sure is. I've come up the mountain between Flat Rock and Asheville a number of times. Sometimes you get into some pretty dense fog there. It's nice to get out of it too, isn't it? But even if it's foggy a little bit here in the morning, it won't be here for long, typically. Comes and it goes. Verse 15, when making plans, one ought to make plans in light of God's will. For that ye ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that. It is a good idea when making plans, the Lord willing be stated, in our thinking at least. James suggests that the ones making the plan need to understand that the Lord's plan for their lives might be different from their plan for their lives. Okay, so here we are. How is your life going to end? We don't know, do we? Will I go to sleep and just not wake up? Will I fall and conk my noggin and pass out and never regain consciousness? Will I have a heart attack? I hope nobody comes in here and starts shooting. You never know what's going to happen. Are we ready to go? I believe we are. We need to be ready. We also need to recognize that our lives will come to an end, and we aren't sure where that end is. My wife and I kind of figured that she'd be the survivor and I'd be the one that went first. The Lord had a different plan. We don't know what's coming, do we? No, not a one of us. If the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. For that is instead. That is, instead of your saying what you have said, ye ought to say, where ye is plural, of course, you plural, and refers to the group of James readers making the elaborate plan, and where ought has been supplied by the translators is, it is necessary that you say, or you must say, and what needs to be said is, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that. And the structure of this statement is that of a conditional statement. The condition is, if the Lord will. And its conclusion is, we shall live and do this or that. Now, get this. If the Lord will, where the Lord refers to Christ suggests, if the Lord has something in mind of purpose or resolve in the sense of wills, wishes, or wants, we shall live is predictive of something which will definitely occur in the future. If it is the Lord's will that someone lives, he's going to live. However, if it's not the Lord's will that he live, he is going to die at the time of God's appointment. And we don't know when that is. Aren't we glad we don't know? Aren't we glad we don't know how? And do. We shall live and do this or that. We will definitely do this thing or that thing. Now, no attempt is made to identify what this or that thing would be. It could be anything, and it would differ from one person or one time to another. And it's left intentionally like this so that we understand it applies to all situations in life. But merely mouthing these words will do no good. God's will must be genuinely desired and sincerely sought before making plans for any venture. Some are priding themselves in their boastings, but boastings like these are evil. But now ye rejoice in your boastings. All such boasting is, or rejoicing is evil. And verse 16 is indicating that it's wrong for some of James' readers to be bragging about their plans for which they've not consulted God or God's will, but introduces a statement between what James' readers should be doing and what they were doing. Now suggests at the present time, at the time James was writing this epistle, ye rejoice. Ye is referring to those who were planning their lives apart from seeking the Lord's will. You are rejoicing, you're glorying, you are priding yourselves, you are bragging, or you are boasting. Now we have another word meaning boastings, or translated boastings here. In the next line, in your boastings, boastings is not the same word translated rejoice. It is in your pretensions or in your arrogances. Are we sometimes arrogant? No, that's other people, right? Yeah, always other people. Never me. Never you. And I've got two words to describe my statement. Yeah, right. We need to be careful. We're as guilty as the next person of some of these things. All such rejoicing of such a kind as this is evil. It's wicked. It's worthless. It's degenerate. If each rejoicing is evil, then all of them combined are also evil. And we come to verse 17, with which we close out chapter 4. We see that it is sin for someone to know to do good, but not to do it. Does that mean that if there's something I know I'm supposed to do but refuse to do it, it's sin? That's what it means. You ever done anything like, no, that's other people, right? Right. Therefore, to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. And verse 17 is drawing the conclusion that believers need to do what is right. When someone knows what he should be doing but is not doing it, it is sin for him. For example, when someone knows that he should be reading his Bible and praying and is not doing it, it is sin. When someone knows that he should be praying about plans he makes but fails to do it, it is sin. And you could go on and on and on and on with this list, but I'll stop right there with the list. Therefore, introduces an inference from what has been said in verses 13 through 16. And it's understood in the sense of then or consequently, accordingly or so. And James has a specific example of making plans without consulting the Lord regarding his will to teach that knowing to do good but not doing it is sin. Of course, you could apply this verse in lots of other situations where we know what we ought to do but don't do it. To him that knoweth to do good, to the one that knows to do good, where knoweth is understood in the sense of he knows, he sees, he perceives, or he recognizes, and good has been placed in a position of emphasis in the Greek text. It's literally to the one who knows good to do. To be doing suggests ongoing action and connects to do with doeth it not. It may instead indicate a contrast between to do and doeth it not, and be understood in the sense of but doeth it not, but is not doing it. To him, to the one who knows to do good but does not do it, it is sin. Sin's been placed in a position of emphasis in the Greek text, and you can understand that. It reads literally sin to him. It is. So when making plans, let's do something. Let's remember to consult God and ask for his will regarding our plan and submit our plan to him for his approval. We must then adjust our plan so that it is consistent with God's will and direction, even if the adjustment we make means forgetting the whole idea. Okay, let's have prayer. Jesse will then come and we'll get started with our prayer requests. Our Father, thank you for the opportunity to come and be here and study this portion of thy word. Help us to practice it. In Jesus' name, amen.